Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 19, 2014, during a live telephone conference call. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, our topic is the Hobby Lobby case to be argued next Wednesday, in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future, and this call, unlike many of our calls, is open to the press, so we welcome members of the press to today's call. We're going to hear from four experts today, so we'll be moving right along. I'll be using the briefest of introductions possible. Their bios are available on our website in the notice you got of this call. We'll be hearing from Professors Stephen M. Bainbridge. He's at the University of California at Los Angeles School of Law. Professor Jared V. Bradley at the University of Notre Dame Law School. Professor Martin S. Lederman at Georgetown University Law Center. And Professor Nelson Tebbe at the Brooklyn Law School. We're going to start. Professor Lederman is going to give us a bit of background. Then we'll hear in turn from Professors Bradley, Professor Lederman once again, then Professors Tebbe and Bainbridge. And then, as always, we'll take questions from the audience, so please be ready with those questions. I'm going to give you some forewarning that because we scheduled this fairly recently, Professor Bradley's only going to be with us until about quarter of the hour. So if you have questions you want to direct to him, get in the queue early once we open up for questions. And with that, Professor Lederman, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Dean. Thank you for hosting this. I'm going to try to speak very briefly. I'm assuming most listeners and readers know about the case. The case involves an intersection of two federal statutes and a backdrop of free exercise clause constitutional law, because that free exercise law is incorporated by reference in one of the two statutes. The first statute is the Affordable Care Act, popularly known as Obamacare, which, among other things, requires, as most people know, the idea of behind the act is to provide every American with access to an affordable health insurance plan. Many Americans get that plan from their employers, though not all. But whether you get it from the employer or from the government or on the exchange, the idea is that it will be something much more affordable and not with regard to your pre-existing conditions and the like. One aspect of the Affordable Care Act that Congress emphasized was to require every health insurance plan in America to cover certain preventive care services, the theory here being that health care would be much less expensive and more efficient if people were to spend more money at the front end doing things to prevent them from becoming sick in the first place or incurring health care costs, and to try to basically incentivize Americans to engage in preventive health care. The Act requires virtually every plan in America to cover a whole list of preventive care services without cost to the participants of the health care plan, that is to say, without the requirement that they copay or pay money for those preventive services. The preventive services are numerous. They include certain immunizations, colorectal cancer screening, women and children preventive care of various sorts. And in particular, Congress said that preventive care that is unique to women has to be included in every plan, and assigned a subgroup of the Health and Human Services, a subagency of the Health and Human Services Department, to determine what forms of women's health care must be covered. And among those that they determined need to be covered are 18 of the 20 listed contraceptive services that have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. So every health care plan in America has to provide its participants with cost-free access to 18 forms of contraceptive methods, from the diaphragm to the sponge, cervical cap, the pill, implantable rods, sterilization surgery, two forms of post-coital emergency contraception, two forms of IUDs, intrauterine devices, and the like. So there's 18 different methods that have to be covered in every health care plan. That's the ACA. The cases are brought under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993, popularly known as RFRA. Now, under RFRA, the federal government, it requires the federal government to provide religious exemptions to generally applicable federal laws of all kinds. It's not unique to the ACA. It basically provides that the federal government can only deny if a generally applicable law imposes what Congress called a substantial burden on the exercise of a person's religion. The federal government has to exempt that person from the application of the generally applicable law unless the government has a compelling interest in denying the exemption and no less restrictive means of advancing that compelling interest. That test was quite self-consciously derived from the free exercise doctrine of the Supreme Court during the decades of the 1960s through the 1980s. The court had articulated this nominal form of strict scrutiny during that three-decade period, but in fact, in application, the court had been quite generally deferential to government and did not require the granting of exemptions under the Free Exercise Clause pursuant to that standard, and Congress intended that that standard, that the court's doctrine, would be incorporated by reference and applied under RFRA. So what is this case about? What is the RFRA claim by? There's three corporations at issue, two of them under the heading of the Hobby Lobby complaint. The other is Conestoga Wood. For ease of convenience, I'll just talk about Hobby Lobby. It's a arts and crafts supply store of 13,000 plus employees that was created by a family of named the Greens. The Greens created this corporation. They have run it themselves since its beginning. It's their baby. They are not the shareholders of the corporation. It's run by a trust, but they are the decision makers. The CEO and the various directors of the corporation are the Greens. And they claim that if they are required to include in their health care plan at least four, maybe more, but at least four of these 18 forms of FDA-approved contraception, the law will require them to violate a religious prohibition. They say that they're, without specifying in great detail why this is so, they claim that if their company's healthcare plan includes, for instance, the two forms of IUD and the two forms of emergency contraception, that they will be sinning, they will be complicit in sin of their employees, at least in some rare cases of their employees' use of those forms of contraception. Their theory is that under their religious traditions, it is immoral to prevent a fertilized egg from being implanted in the uterine wall, the embryo to be implanted in the wall, that some of these forms of contraception may, on occasion, may not, but may, on rare occasion, prevent the implantation of the embryo in the uterine wall. And therefore, if their health care plan provides in reimbursement to their employees to use these forms of contraception, and the employees do it, and in a rare case it prevents uterine implantation, that they, the Greens, will be complicit in the sin of their employees of ending what they view as a human life, and that therefore that imposes a substantial burden on the exercise of their religion. It will make them complicit in what they deem to be sinful behavior. The government comes back and makes a threshold argument, which is that this kind of claim cannot be recognized under RFRA at all. My personal view is that there's less to that than meets the eye. That's not really where the action is, but that's what most people have focused on. And the government argues in the alternative that even if RFRA applies, that this case is like many of the other cases the Supreme Court has decided over the years in the commercial sector. The government has a compelling interest in not granting religious exemptions because it will impose a significant cost on the employees that are entitled to this benefit, and that the government doesn't have a less restrictive means of advancing that compelling interest. Folks, roughly speaking, did I cover the field, the short version of the case?
I think you've done quite well.
So with that, I think Professor Bradley.
Well, thank you very much for the very helpful introduction. You've covered a somewhat complex area of law, and looking back over that area for 40 or more years, really quite well. I think that I was particularly interested, Professor Lederman, in your observation that the compelling interest test in at least this particular area of the law, and I think here, I think you were talking specifically about the 27 years or so between Schubert versus Werner in 1963 and 1990 with the Smith case, you observed, if I remember correctly, that the test, the compelling interest test, was in fact one that provided relief to fewer religious plaintiffs than one might well think it would. I think that's accurate, at least in the Supreme Court of the United States. I'm not so sure if at the lower court level, the amount of relief granted under the compelling interest test was perhaps greater than what the court at the highest level granted. But nonetheless, it's a very interesting fact of the jurisprudence of the Schubert compelling interest test. Now, nonetheless, having said that, I think that in this case, in the Hobby Lobby cases, the real action will really come at the front end. I think that even granting the compelling nature of the state's or the federal government's interest in gender equality and in public health, I think that the government will very likely, and in my judgment should, falter if when required to show that this mandate, the HHS mandate, is the least restrictive way to obtain or achieve these compelling, at least for argument's sake, let's say compelling government objectives. And for that reason, there has been a lot of attention focused on the threshold questions, which according to the RFRA statute would be whether there's an exercise of religion by the RFRA plaintiff, in this case, the Hobby Lobby Corporation, for example. I think you're right, too, Professor Liederman, that the focus is very often on the threshold question, but I think actually the arguments made there really belong at the back end, and I think that's my main point, and I'll explain what I mean by that in just a minute. But as a threshold question, which I take to be whether a for-profit corporation can, you know, is able to or is capable of the exercise of religion, the question is put that way most often, and I think it signals by the way it's put that the matter is one of genuine capacity. I'm tempted to say it's an existential question. What could an entity do? Not a moral question about what it should do, or a legal question about what it should be permitted to do or prohibited from doing. It's as if the question has to do with the truth or the real world abilities of an entity, in this case, a for-profit corporation. And if the question is put that way, I think actually it's a very puzzling question. And for myself, I can't think of any good reason why a for-profit corporation just as such can't be a RFRA plaintiff. So let me give it maybe some example of what I mean or illustrate what I mean, perhaps argue in favor of that view. I'm sitting right here now speaking in the offices of my employer, which has over 5,000 employees, controls assets of more than $10 billion, and has a very successful football team with a lucrative contract with NBC. Now, I don't work for the Dallas Cowboys. I work for the University of Notre Dame, and it's in court on similar claims. It is challenging the mandate in court, and actually it fared badly in the Seventh Circuit, but there was no doubt even in the Seventh Circuit that Notre Dame was a qualified RFRA plaintiff, and it's a corporation. Now, on the other hand, down the street from me is a sort of 55 or so person for-profit corporation, a design corporation, and it's covered by the HHS mandate. And according to at least the arguments I see by the administration, that group down the street, although it may be run by and entirely staffed by persons who are devout believers in one religion, in the case I'm thinking of Christianity, they somehow categorically can't be RFRA plaintiffs. Now, the only essential difference, as I understand it, between a profit and nonprofit corporation is simply that in a for-profit corporation, some people, let's call them the owners, you know, bear the risk of loss if the corporation loses money, but stand to gain some money if the corporation turns a profit. Now, that's an interesting and perhaps important difference, but I can't myself see why that would change the capacity of a group of people, any group of people who are collaborating in and through the corporate form for whatever purposes are specified in the corporate charter. So an example of the complexity of Notre Dame University, it's not for profit, but the complexity the size and the bureaucratic inner workings of the corporation, which is Notre Dame, would be much like a Fortune 500 company, but being not-for-profit apparently qualifies uncontroversially as a RFRA plaintiff, and the corporation down the street, much, much smaller and informal, and in a certain way much more personal, isn't. So I think that actually that way of thinking about the question is misplaced, and frankly, I'm kind of confounded at the prospect that there's something in the nature of owners making or losing money that disqualifies them from being a RFRA plaintiff. Now, I do think there are arguments that have the real arguments on both sides of these cases, but I think that the arguments that are being mounted against the threshold status, if you will, of Hobby Lobby as a RFRA plaintiff are actually policy reasons or good reasons in some cases, reasons that have some value and force against actually granting the exemption. To put that point perhaps a little bit differently, there are plausible reasons against granting the exemption that Hobby Lobby seeks under RFRA. I myself don't think that in the end those reasons carry the day, and my own judgment is that RFRA not only applies or is available to Hobby Lobby, but that Hobby Lobby should obtain the relief it seeks. But there are serious reasons against that judgment, that conclusion of mine. You can find them in many places. I think one place one could look for the kinds of reasons I have in mind, and I think these are the reasons that really are put in play against this threshold possibility of Hobby Lobby. You can find them, I think, in the New Mexico Supreme Court opinion in another RFRA sort of case. I say that analogically, not literally, involving Elaine Photography, where the Supreme Court of New Mexico, takes up the question, the problem of granting religiously grounded exemptions to commercial operations, in that case, a small one, no doubt, but Elaine Photography, and raises legitimate concerns about the scope of any such possible exemption and the effect upon other people, including customers, in that case, same-sex couples who might be customers. As I say, these are legitimate and plausible points. I don't think in the end conclusive or decisive, but they really do belong at the back end of a RFRA analysis, that is to argue against granting the exemption. So in conclusion, I think that the most potent points to be made against Hobby Lobby's case really don't have to do with their qualifications as an eligible plaintiff. I think they have to do with granting the exemption, but I think actually, since RFRA establishes that the exemption ought to be granted, unless there's a compelling interest in least restrictive means, I do think that the least restrictive means question here is a defeater for the administration. So my final point, or a different way of putting my final point, would be to say that I think the reasons on offer, for example, in Elaine Photography, are reasons to be opposed to RFRA, and they are policy arguments and arguments about justice, which probably should be or would be on the lips of members of Congress, the Senate and the House, someday soon, perhaps, arguing in favor of a repeal or a significant modification of RFRA itself. And on the lips of these political figures, you might say they're perfectly legitimate arguments, although I think in the end not finally persuasive. But as arguments against the threshold status of Hobby Lobby, I think they're not only insufficient, they're just simply misplaced. And with that, I'll turn it over, I think, back to Professor Lederman.
Thank you, Professor Bradley. I hope I'm not going to disappoint our readers and listeners too much to say that I think that we actually have quite a bit of common ground here, at least on the threshold question. We have some common ground. One small point, the Elaine Photography case that Professor Bradley mentioned is actually being considered by the court at its conference for certiorari on Friday. But that the petition in that case does not raise a religious liberty claim. It raises a compelled speech claim.
And
we'll probably find out on Monday whether the court grants that. I'd like to make a point about the threshold, thinking about the threshold questions, and then go to the question of what happens if RFRA is applied. On the threshold questions, I tend to agree with Professor Bradley that I think that there's probably not a categorical exclusion of for-profit corporations from the scope of RFRA. I can imagine cases in which for-profit corporations might be said to exercise religion in a way that a law might impinge. Having said that, I don't think that this for-profit corporation can raise this kind of claim, but I also want to suggest that that's not really what's important here. The claim here is that the federal law requires someone, the Greens in particular, to violate religious obligations that they have to avoid complicity with what they deem to be sinful conduct. I don't know that there's a religion in the world, and the complaints in this case do not allege that this religion imposes any obligations on Hobby Lobby Incorporated. I don't think that the religions at issue here, which, by the way, are Mennonite religion in the Conestoga case and an evangelical church in the other, or fundamentalist church in the other, impose any obligations on a for-profit corporation. So this kind of RFRA claim I don't think can be brought by the corporation, but I don't think that really matters. I think a fair reading of the complaints in the briefs demonstrates, and I think Professor Bainbridge will agree with this, that the real burden on religion, if there is any, is on the Greens as individuals, who are claiming that in some respect they are being required as directors of the corporation, not as shareholders, but as directors to be complicit in sinful conduct. It's not clear what the nature of that theory is, and maybe we'll get to talk about that a little bit more in our discussion. I'm a bit doubtful about that, but the doctrine puts certain limits on the court interrogating those kinds of claims about whether and in what way this might impose a religious obligation on them. They've alleged it at a very broad and general and unspecified level of detail without specificity about what it is exactly that they will be doing that their religion thinks is impermissible. But I'm willing to assume, and I do think that those people who think that this case is going to be about whether RFRA applies to for-profit corporations are going to be largely disappointed. I don't think that's where the action is. The action is in how should RFRA apply, and here I do part ways with Professor Bradley, but interestingly, I'm a strong supporter of RFRA. I worked on it in the Clinton administration, helped that administration pass analogous federal statutes. What's different here is really that the claim here is for something the Supreme Court has never been willing to do in many decades of free exercise law, and that is to grant a religious exemption to an actor in the commercial sphere with respect to commercial activity. And in a series of cases going all the way back to 1944, the court has always denied such claims virtually unanimously in almost all those cases, including involving requested exemptions from Social Security payments, from wage and hour laws, from child labor laws, and the like. In every case, the court has said, in the commercial setting, the government has a compelling interest in not granting religious exemptions to individuals or the companies themselves. Why is that the case? Because in the commercial setting, virtually always, not always, but almost always, such an exemption would impose a significant burden on third parties, customers, competitors, or in this case, employees. And the government, I think, has a compelling interest, maybe this will segue into what Professor Tebbe is about to say, I don't think that makes RFRA unconstitutional. To the contrary, I think the better way to read RFRA is consistent with the court's jurisprudence, which is that the avoiding these third-party harms is a compelling interest that the government has, and there's no less restrictive way of avoiding it if the religious exemption were to be granted. So though I'm a very strong RFRA proponent, I think in the commercial sector, it has in the past, as the Free Exercise Clause did, and should in the future, have very modest, if any, application in terms of granting religious exemptions. Before turning it over to Professor Tebbe, I guess I would like to just identify what I see as the most important of the government's compelling interests here. The interest here, as I said, at the general level is making sure that people use all these different forms of preventive services so as to improve their health and cut down on healthcare costs. But contraception in particular, and IUDs more particularly than that, the simple answer is that this will reduce significantly unintended or unplanned pregnancies. And that has many virtues, not least of which is diminishing the incidence of abortion among people who do use contraception, and in particular who use the IUD among the most effective long-term contraceptive methods, and the one that women are less likely to use because of its high upfront costs. And so if this statute works the way Congress and HHS intended it to, it will prevent a significant number of unintended pregnancies with all of the virtues that brings. And therefore, to grant a religious exemption would impose quite a significant cost on the women who will get pregnant who would not otherwise have gotten pregnant when they intended to. And we can talk more about less restrictive means, I guess, in the discussion, because I want to turn it over to Professors Tebbe and Bainbridge.
Professor Tebbe, go right ahead.
Thanks very much. I've been part of a group of scholars who's been trying to draw attention in this case to the possible impact that granting an exemption to Hobby Lobby and the other organizations in this case would have on third parties, and in particular on employees. Part of this is as Professor Lederman pointed out, implicit in and part of the free exercise and RFRA analysis, because the court has said in its free exercise cases that it's reluctant to grant exemptions to religious actors when that would shift costs to third parties. So it's part of the analysis in RFRA and also in the free exercise clause context. But there's another provision of law that hasn't been mentioned so far on the call that's implicated, and that is the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. There's an Establishment Clause rule that's been written into the Supreme Court's case law for some time now, in more than one case, that holds that while the government can voluntarily lift burdens that it would otherwise impose on religious actors, when I say voluntarily, I mean lift burdens, even where lifting that burden is not required by the Free Exercise Clause. So it can accommodate religious actors in that way. Even when it elects to do so, and even though it can do so, there's a limitation on that ability of the government to accommodate religious actors, and that is that it can't shift the costs that would otherwise be borne by those religious actors onto third parties. In this case, the third parties that would be impacted if Hobby Lobby prevails are employees. So there's a real concern in the Supreme Court's Establishment Clause case law that when the government voluntarily accommodates religious actors and that results in a burden on third parties, that raises Establishment Clause concerns. The court has said that a few times, including in a case concerning RLUIPA, which is kind of analogous statute to RFRA, although it applies only in land use and prison settings. In a case concerning RLUIPA, the court said that properly applying RLUIPA, courts must take adequate account of the burdens of a requested accommodation may impose on third parties. And that was building on a case, an even earlier case called the State of Thornton against Caldor, where the court kind of first implemented that rule, or one of the first times it did in the Establishment Clause setting. This does not mean that RFRA is unconstitutional in its entirety. I quite agree with Mari Lederman, Professor Lederman, that it is a constitutional law. Although at least one amicus brief in the case urges the court to strike down RFRA in its entirety, I don't think that's the right way to go, and I don't think it's required by the court's case law. It's simply that where applying RFRA would shift burdens to third parties, as it would in this case, there's a constitutional problem. The burden that would be shifted, just to make it perfectly plain, is the cost of contraception coverage. That is, if female employees or the female relatives of male employees who are covered under their plan are denied coverage as a consequence of the court's decision in Hobby Lobby, they'd have to go out and either purchase contraception without coverage or purchase health insurance coverage. And so there's a clear and identifiable cost on certain people. Some people have raised some kind of concerns about our argument, about our Establishment Clause argument. One is that every accommodation of religion imposes some cost on third parties, and so they've said that the implications of applying this rule in the way that we suggest it would be widespread. And I don't think that's true. I mean, it seems to me that there are some burdens that are imposed on religious actors that are purely bureaucratic, or that impose small, very small costs on a diffuse, number of people. For example, legislative accommodations that recognize that people have conscientious objections to war in all forms, and protect people from being compelled to serve in combat positions, may impose some slight costs on a diffuse group of members of the public, but not on a discrete or a readily identifiable group, as in this case. Other people have pointed to a case called Amos, where the court approved of an accommodation in Title VII, the employment discrimination statute. And that law says that, in general, employers cannot discriminate on the basis of religion when they make hiring decisions. But it accommodates a certain narrow category of religious employers who are discriminating on the basis of religion in order to ensure that their employees are members of the faith. Churches themselves, for example, are houses of worship. And there was a case called Amos where someone was denied an employment position on the basis of religion, and that imposed a real cost on that person. And we think that case is properly limited to churches and houses of worship themselves. And in the decision, the court said as much and said that real concerns might be raised if that kind of accommodation were applied in settings where a religious organization was involved in the commercial sphere. So I have views about other aspects of the case, but mainly I wanted to just offer this Establishment Clause argument as a powerful way of ruling in favor of the government in this case.
Professor Bainbridge, go right ahead, please.
Thank you. My interest in the Hobby Lobby case was piqued by a telling colloquy between U.S. District Judge Reggie Walton and U.S. Department of Justice lawyer Benjamin Berwick in the Tyndale House Publishers case, which raised essentially the same issues as the Hobby Lobby case. Berwick argued there that employers who chose to incorporate their business are precluded from raising free exercise objections to regulations affecting their business. And in response to that, Judge Walton posed the following hypothetical. He said, "My wife has a medical practice. She has a corporation, but she's the sole owner and sole stock owner. If she had strongly held religious beliefs and she made that known, that she operated her medical practice from that perspective, could she be required to pay for these types of items if she felt that was causing her to violate her religious beliefs?" And Berwick replied that the corporation and its shareholders are separate legal persons. So Judge Walton summarized his understanding of the government's position as being that his wife would have to go as an individual proprietor with no corporation protection in order to assert her religious rights. And Berwick did not contest that characterization. And I think it's a fair characterization of the government position. So in effect, the government wants the Supreme Court to elevate form over substance. And the problem is that nobody's really done a very good job of explaining why form ought to prevail over substance in this case, where allowing it to do so would defeat basic rights to freely exercise one's religion. In my article, Using Reverse Veil Piercing to Vindicate the Free Exercise Rights of Incorporated Employers, which appeared in the Greenbag Journal and which you can find easily online, I propose that the Supreme Court use reverse veil piercing precisely to avoid putting form over substance. Reverse veil piercing is a corporate law doctrine pursuant to which a court disregards the corporation's separate legal personality, thereby allowing the shareholder to claim benefits that would otherwise be available only to individuals. Now, it's important to recognize that invoking reverse veil piercing in the mandate case would not be outcome determinative. Instead, it would simply provide a coherent doctrinal framework for determining whether the corporation is so intertwined with the religious beliefs of its shareholders, that we should treat them as a single person. Specifically, I propose that the Supreme Court adopt a three-part test. First, is there such substantial identity of the shareholders' religious beliefs in the manner in which the corporation has operated, purposes to which it's devoted? The corporation is effectively the shareholders' alter ego. Second, how strong is the government's interest in ensuring that the corporation's employees get the mandated coverage? Third, would reverse veil piercing advance significant public policies? In my view, all three prongs are satisfied here. Hobby Lobby admittedly is a large company, but it's still a closely held family-owned business in which the religious values of its shareholders demonstrably play a prominent role. Second, the government interest here is weak, as demonstrated by the government having already undermined its own mandate by carving out exemptions for grandfathered plans, employers with fewer than 50 employees, members of a recognized religious sect, or certain religious employers. As Judge Walton observed in discussing the Tyndale case, a law cannot be regarded as promoting an interest of the highest order where it permits appreciable damage to that supposedly vital interest. Finally, the free exercise issues that would be vindicated by using reverse veil piercing are of the highest order. As the Supreme Court put it in West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett, no official can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein. Or as the Supreme Court observed in the Yoder case, the values protected by the religious freedom clauses have been zealously protected. And importantly, the court went on to say, sometimes even at the expense of other interests of admittedly high social importance. Now, I'll leave for others with more expertise in the issue as to whether or not the commercial context here devalues those claims. But nevertheless, it's undeniable that there is a free exercise issue here. Now, critics of my argument include 44 corporate law professors who apparently were so scared that the Supreme Court might accept it that they jointly filed an amicus brief in support of the government. I have a reply to them coming out in the Virginia Law Review's online edition next week. I think that none of their arguments against applying reverse veil piercing here have any validity. But I'd be happy to leave that, in the interest of time, to the Q&A. But one point deserves mention. Some critics have argued that the Supreme Court has already decided this issue. They point to Domino's Pizza versus McDonald, a 2006 case that raised the ability of a shareholder of a corporation to raise claims under Section 1981. Alleging that a contract between Domino's and his corporate franchisee had been terminated by reasons of racial animus. And a Section 1981 claim requires the plaintiff first establish the existence of a contractual relationship to which he's a party. And the court ruled that the plaintiff here was unable to do so because it's a fundamental principle of corporation law that a shareholder has no rights under the corporation's contracts. Now, as I explain in my response coming out next week, I don't take McDonald very seriously as a problem for my argument. First, the court made no effort to analyze the issues, but simply dismissed them out of hand. There's no citation of authority, no justification of the claims being made, and no effort to address the points that I've been making in my articles or on my blog at ProfessorBainbridge.com, all of which I think makes McDonald a fairly weak precedential read. Second, the McDonald case involved purely contractual rights and statutory rights as opposed to the fundamental First Amendment concerns presented here. And finally, the court relied on the plain text of Section 1981 to reach its result, and there's no comparable statutory limitation at issue here. All of which is why I think McDonald is anything but dispositive of the issues. As for the rest of those issues, I'll be happy to leave them for the Q&A, and I'll turn it back over to Dean now.
Thank you very much, Professor. In a moment, we're going to all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And a quick reminder that Professor Bradley's with us for only just another few minutes here. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple hundred people calling in today, so I'm going to ask folks to be as concise as possible with their questions so we can get to as many callers as possible. Let me make a quick announcement that tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be discussing on our teleforum call federal hate crimes. We'll also be revisiting the Hobby Lobby case next Wednesday when it's being argued. We'll have a couple people in the courtroom listening to the oral argument, and they'll provide their analysis later that same day. That's next Wednesday. Before we turn to the audience, let me give Jerry Bradley, Professor Bradley, a minute or two to respond to anything he might have heard, since he'll be leaving us very shortly. Professor Bradley, do you have anything to add?
I do. Thank you very much, Dean, and I'll try to be as brief as I can. I'd like to take up some of what Professor Tebbe said about the Establishment Clause issues in this case, and I myself would not and do not want to be heard to be here conceding that we're talking about the Establishment Clause, but speaking philosophically and matters of basic fairness, I think it's quite right that in any case, including this one, where an exemption is sought, it's very important for whichever authority has the authority to grant or withhold the exemption, consider the impact upon others who are foreseeably affected. And the question really is it fair to impose whatever the burdens would be upon other people, which burdens result or arise from the exemption? And that's a serious moral question. Again, I'm not sure that it's an Establishment Clause issue, but I do take issue with a couple of other Professor Tebbe's points about the Establishment Clause. I don't think his efforts to distinguish the conscientious objector accommodation during the times when we had a draft really work. I think that the effect of relieving conscientious objectors on religious grounds from military duty, especially combat duty, I think those effects run straight away foreseeably to particular other persons. Perhaps it'd be more difficult to list them by their proper names, their surnames and given names, than it would be to find a list of the employees of Hobby Lobby, for example. But nonetheless, I think in both cases we're talking about specific persons whose burdens are increased by virtue of granting an accommodation. I think that's true with municipal and public employees who recognize a kind of Sabbatarian objection to being made to work on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It's true in other areas of life as well. Family Medical Leave Act imposes burdens upon coworkers who have to take up the slack for a man or woman, as the case may be, who's giving leave to take care of a dying relative or a new baby. So I think that's a common feature, and the question is fairness. And I don't think there's any good reason to affirm a kind of exclusion of the possibility of burdening particular persons. And lastly, with Hobby Lobby, I don't think it's actually a case such as Professor Tebbe describes, or I should say that I think his description of it actually is a bit of a trick, because the status quo ante was that the employees of Hobby Lobby were presumably on their own to get the contraception and abortifacient drugs of their choice until the mandate was enacted. Now, the mandate shifts that burden onto Hobby Lobby as the employer. So at this point, the only reason why there may be an appearance of Hobby Lobby trying to shift a burden back onto employees, that appearance arises only because of the law, that is the HHS mandate, which of course is precisely what Hobby Lobby is challenging. So that's what I mean when I say I think there's a bit of a trick at work there. And with that, Dean, I'd be happy to take questions if there are any coming my way.
Thank you very much, Professor. We'll open the floor to questions. Looks like we've got some in the queue here. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is for Professor Lederman. I was curious about his statement earlier on that 18 of the 20 FDA-approved contraceptives were required to be covered by the mandate. I hadn't heard that before and just wanted to hear an explanation of why that differs from the way others have been describing what the mandate requires. Thank you.
I'm not sure anyone does dispute that. I think it's pretty clear that it covers 18 of the 20 FDA-approved methods.
My understanding is that it requires all 20 of the 20.
No, it doesn't require it doesn't cover condoms and vasectomies because those were deemed by HHS because the language of the statute refers to I don't have the language in front of me, but women's services and HHS determined that those two are for men. Or at least are used directly in the first instance by men. So condoms and vasectomies are not covered.
Thank you very much.
All right. If you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on our telephone, on your telephone. We've got a couple hundred callers here, just one question pending, and then our lines will be open. So feel free to ring in. Let's go to our next caller.
A quick question for Professor Lederman and maybe secondarily Professor Tebbe. I'm curious, the state of Washington is considering legislation that would require all insurance plans to cover elective abortions. So I wonder if your analysis would be different if that were the rule. And secondarily, you could easily imagine, say, a for-profit group of five doctors in OBGYN practice, and they are Catholics and won't perform abortions, and a patient comes to them, can't get a late-term abortion anywhere else, and wants these for-profit doctors to provide an abortion. And if a state required that and had a state RFRA identical to the federal RFRA, I wonder if your analysis would be any different, or if you would maintain that the third-party harm to the patient who can't get an abortion overcomes the right of the doctors not to participate.
Nelson, you want to take that, or should I?
Go ahead.
Okay. I don't know anything. I apologize. I'm not aware of this legislation in Washington. I think certainly the form of the analysis would be the same, but it's very unusual, if not unheard of, for any legislature in America to require anyone to perform abortions. In fact, in general, there's no need for religious exemptions because there's a general rule, at least in the federal system, that no one will, by federal law, be required to be involved in the performance of abortions. So I don't know enough about that bill or about whether religious exemptions would be made to it by the Washington legislature, which would have and so I can't really say that much about it. I think the point that Nelson, Professor Tebbe makes, which is that in construing that legislation, I think one would need to take account. I guess the legislature there would simply be granting, would be requiring it without an exemption at all. And the only question would be whether the Establishment Clause or something else prohibits the legislature from doing that. I take it that's your question. I'm not sure that the Establishment Clause would. My view on that is a bit different from Professor Tebbe's. I tend to agree with some of the criticisms that Professor Bradley raised. I think the court's case law on Establishment Clause limits are different. That's if Washington did grant a religious exemption. If Washington didn't grant a religious exemption but required everyone to perform abortions or insurance companies to cover them, many people would think that that's a bad piece of legislation, but I'm not sure what the constitutional objection would be to it, and RFRA wouldn't have anything to say about it.
Even if Washington had a state RFRA?
I'm sorry, if Washington had a state RFRA, how would the state RFRA apply? I suppose the structure of the analysis would be the same, but I would need to see what the state's interest is in making sure that that women have accessibility to those forms of abortion without religious exemptions. I would be shocked if a legislature were that categorical in this day and age, but I don't know what's going on in Washington.
Professor Benridge or Professor Tebbe, anything on this point?
This is Professor Tebbe. I agree with Professor Lederman on that analysis, and I guess I would only just add that I think in the questioner's question, there was some reference to an emergency situation. And most statutes that grant religious accommodations, even with regard to terminating a pregnancy, don't apply in situations of an emergency. So I guess I would just add that. But I also want to respond a little bit to the question, to the concerns that Professor Bradley raised and that were seconded by Professor Lederman a minute ago, because I don't share them, and I just want to explain briefly why. Again, I think there's a real difference between a statute that exempts a single individual or two individuals, because usually they're not very numerous, from serving in a war, in a combat position, in a time when conscription is in place, and the situation here. I mean, I think it's very hard to identify the number of people or the degree of burden that would be shifted onto them by that kind of narrow exemption for only for conscientious objectors who have an articulated and provable, well, not provable, sincere objection to serving in a combat position in all wars. In this situation, there's a discrete cost involved. That is, there's a dollar sign, a numerical value that can be attached to the burden that would be shifted from employers to women employees or covered women of who are associated with male employees in these cases. There's some dispute about what that exact number is, but it's in the hundreds of dollars per year. And I just think that's a very, very different situation than when we're talking about the draft. Professor Bradley raised another point, which is about baselines. The question is, you know, if it's the case that women employees and other women in the United States don't have a right to contraception coverage or health insurance that covers contraception in the first place, how could it possibly burden them if, as a consequence of the Hobby Lobby decision, they don't have that right under RFRA, or RFRA results in them not receiving that coverage? And I think that's a serious argument against our position. It's another way of phrasing it is that you have to look at the statute, the ACA, in combination with RFRA, and when they're read together, women just don't have a right to contraception coverage in the first place. I don't think that is the right baseline. I think it's much more natural to read the ACA as shifting the baseline for virtually all women in America who will now be able to receive coverage without a copayment for these contraceptive services. That includes women who are employed by certain religiously affiliated nonprofits, because the insurance carrier will have to cover them. So the baseline is not only a temporal one. You know, what did people enjoy, these women enjoy, before RFRA kicked in, but also a comparative one. What do all other women in America enjoy? What is the comparable level of coverage that virtually all women in America will receive? And I think that the more natural reading is that women actually would suffer a burden if Hobby Lobby prevails.
Dean, this is Professor Lederman again, and just quick response to Nelson and try to respond to something that Professor Bainbridge said along these lines. I don't take his reading of the conscientious objection cases. I think that obviously the third-party harms there are quite severe. Other people have to go and fight and die, and therefore I agree with Justice Harlan in his Wells concurrence that if that statute had been a religious exemption, it would violate the Establishment Clause, but in fact that's why he would construe it to not be limited to religion, but to be an exemption available to anyone with such strongly held views. But the important point is not whether this would or would not violate the Establishment Clause. The important point is that the imposition of a significant burden on third parties, harm to third parties, clearly raises a serious, significant constitutional question. And that's sufficient to construe RFRA not to require that burden be borne by women. And I would slightly dispute, not disagree with Professor Tebbe about the way to characterize the burden on women here, but to say it's not so much just the shifting of a few dollars from as important as that may be. The point is that many women will not, in fact, either use contraception who would under this new law, or would use forms of contraception that are less effective. And so the real acute burden being suffered by the employees, if the exemption is granted, is that they will become pregnant when they did not intend to be, with much greater frequency, which will lead them to the difficult choice of whether to have abortions or to bear children that they did not wish to bear at that time. And that is a significant burden, and that just leads me to Professor Bainbridge's point. He said in passing that the government has provided many exemptions to this rule, and that is just inaccurate. As a matter of fact, as I've discussed in many blog posts, the law covers virtually every woman in America, or will when plans make significant changes. There's a timing issue with respect to grandfathered plans, but the design of this law is that virtually all women in America, except those who are employees of churches, effectively, will be entitled to this benefit, which will prevent unintended pregnancies.
Professor Bainbridge, do you want to weigh in here, or should we go to the next caller?
There's been a lot of talking by the panelists. Why don't you give your audience a chance to ask a question?
We've got just a few minutes left. Let's try and take another caller.
Hello, and this is for Professor Bainbridge. Professor was very interested in your three-prong test and was wondering, I don't know how closely held the Hobby Lobby family is. I don't know how many members there are, but more importantly, perhaps, is at what point would a closely held corporation become too large? And, of course, this involves line drawing, but I'm interested in where you would draw the line in saying that your one of the prongs of your three-prong test would not apply, if you understand my question.
Yeah, it's a perfectly legitimate question, and it's a question, of course, that comes up in any reverse veil piercing case or also in any standard veil piercing case, is, you know, how many shareholders is a sufficiently large group that you would decide that corporation is not their alter ego. And, you know, we know from studies by Bob Thompson at Georgetown that sort of three is the median number. Once you get above about 10 or 12 shareholders, the courts become much more reluctant to pierce because it becomes much harder to show the degree of identity between the corporation and the shareholder that you need to treat them as a single person. Any line that you draw would be inherently arbitrary, but certainly I would say, you know, the more cohesive the group is, the larger the number that you would think possible. The less cohesive, the more dispersed, you know, the smaller the number. So, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of certainly not larger than double digits, and probably towards the low end of that.
Understood, and thank you. And do you happen to know how many family members there are on that own the stock of Hobby Lobby?
This is Professor Lederman again. I mean, this is one of the problems with Professor Bainbridge's argument, I think. Hobby Lobby, they aren't the shareholders. The Greens are not the shareholders, so his theory doesn't apply to the Hobby Lobby case. In Conestoga Wood, the family members are all of the shareholders. I think there's 4 to 6 of them. I forget the exact number. That's the companion case. And that involves Pennsylvania law, and I think that Professor Bainbridge is asking the Supreme, but I don't think the case is really about shareholder rights. I think this is something of a red herring, and I don't think it would be advisable for the Supreme Court to get entangled in whether the Pennsylvania Supreme Court would, as a matter of Pennsylvania corporate law, recognize reverse veil piercing in this context, where it has never recognized it before. I think the real question as to the Hans, which is the name of the family in Conestoga Wood, or the Greens in Hobby Lobby, is not the burden on them as shareholders. It's not clear that there is one, but instead the burden on them as directors or decision makers of the corporations in question.
Dean, could I just respond to that?
Yes, go right ahead, and this will have to be the last word.
I would love for Professor Lederman then to respond to Judge Walton's hypothetical. Why should Judge Walton's physician wife have to be a sole proprietor in order to assert her religious beliefs? I mean, you know, you're elevating form over substance in a way that simply doesn't make sense.
Dean, if I just want to make it clear, I don't have a view one way or the other on whether Pennsylvania law should or should not engage in reverse veil piercing in that case, but I don't think it's a question for the Supreme Court here.
All right. Well, let me thank Professors Bainbridge, Bradley, Lederman, and Tebbe. A reminder to our audience, we'll be revisiting this case next Wednesday after it's argued with another slate of experts who will be attending oral argument and giving you the benefit of their download next Wednesday. Before that, tomorrow, we do have a teleforum conference call at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on federal hate crimes, and I invite you to join us for that. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.